Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the China Startup Pulse. I am Ryan Shukin and I am so excited because this marks the chronological 1 year anniversary of the China Startup Pulse. I really am thankful for everybody that's helped us get this far. And I want to take the opportunity to thank Vivian and Darren and Chi, our awesome producers that we've had, David, our incredible sound engineer, and Todd Embley, who helped build and found this from the very beginning. It's been an incredible journey, and I'm so happy to have this. In this episode, we talk with Jeffrey Handley, who is a serial entrepreneur with experience in over 5 startups and 30 investments after that. He has had the journey from being a startup, an entrepreneur, a founder, all the way into being a partner and a VC and an investor and an advisor. He talks about how starting a business with his brothers was really important and that he loves focusing on uncomfortable ideas, how choosing the right mentors, having a plan, and focusing on how people get things done, not what, is one of the most important things you can do. This journey has also given him an incredible perspective on the duty and responsibility of investors, the accountability that they need to make, and the promises that go all around. There's a ton of really good information in here, and I can't wait to get into it. So let's do it. Hey everyone, I am here with Jeffrey Handley, and I'm going to give a quick intro into this individual's massive and extensive experience in not only doing startups, but also being an investor and understanding the relationships between China and the Western world. So Jeffrey has done over 5 companies that he's co-founded and been a part of. He's invested in over 30. He started Hype Factory in New Zealand, which was one of the first mobile agencies in the world at the time. Also Snack Media in the US, and he did Pacific Comms in 1996, 1997 in Hong Kong. He was born in Hong Kong, and in 1986 was his first time into China in Guangzhou, which was a very different world. And you offer a very different perspective. So really welcome. Thanks for being here, Jeffrey. How's it going?
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
And this is a really special show because this is actually the moment that we started the podcast a year ago.
Wow. Congratulations.
So this is the year-long thing. Even though it's not the 52nd episode, it is the moment and the timing in which it's 1 year. 1 year long.
It's been 1 year worth of good listening to.
Yeah. And we're really, really lucky to have you. I want to ask, when you first started starting in Hong Kong, was there an environment for entrepreneurism, an environment, a support network, or anything like that? Like, what was your support network? Why did you even start?
I think a personal point of view, my background, my family background has always been entrepreneurs on both sides, my mom and my dad's side. We were always encouraged to do our own thing and to do different things. I'm one of 3 brothers. I'm the oldest. And we were encouraged to, after university, to get a job. But spend no more than 1 year at someone else's company and find a place to work that was really big, understand and appreciate all the things that they did wrong and all the values that they didn't share with you, especially around people and how treating people and how to motivate people. And after that, then figure out what you want to do and do something yourself or with others. And I've been lucky that I've started a number of my business. I've actually started with my brothers too. But in Hong Kong at the time, no, there was very little in the way of an ecosystem or an infrastructure. There are definitely people that are still there now and very active that were active then and very important then to help build the scene. But there was hardly anything there. Mm-hmm. And it was the beginning of the internet. No one really knew what they were doing, I think. Well, we were just building as we were going. You know?
Yeah, yeah. That's the best when there's no one there to tell you what you're doing wrong, because there is no way to be wrong.
Yeah.
It's all just inventing and building for the future.
Yeah.
So you've done .com, you've done mobile, you've done ad tech, investing, Internet of Things, AI, like just it keeps on going and going. Mm. When you were first working on mobile, what was that like? And why was it mobile? What got you into that?
The first business I got involved in and my own experience in the internet in the mid-90s was I already went straight to intranet in 96. Mm. So I was always kind of figuring out what was next. So when people were dealing with the web, I was looking at intranets when people didn't really know what they were. And by the time after the crash, which most people told us was a stupid time to start a business, around 99, 2000. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was a great idea, great time to start a business then. And everyone was looking at the screens on their desks. And I think that time in Asia really showed me that it was not going to be about the screens on your desks. Mm-hmm. Just understanding, I guess, growing up in Hong Kong and also seeing how cultures worked and also the infrastructure. And I knew it would be on your phone. Mm. You asked me how it was. It was really difficult because people would look at you like you were insane.
Yeah, I mean, in the early 2099, even saying that, people would be like, "What was that? That was the Razer flip phones were around, or
didn't
whatnot.
Even have those yet.
Didn't even have those yet.
Nokia screens with an LCD dot matrix screen. Yeah, if you've got a vision, it's got to be bold and it's got to be scary, right? It's got to be scary to others and scary to you, and that's what gives you the passion behind it, right? You don't really hear about generals who won easy battles. Mm-hmm. You hear about generals who beat the odds and had hindsight, foresight in one.
Absolutely.
And I think that was a big part of it. I think even just growing up as a kid, I've always been the person that's asked why.
Yeah.
Probably more than my parents would have liked or teachers would have liked. You know, it's like, it's just why or why not? Why can't I do this? Has really been the answer. So mobile was definitely, it was tough. It was really tough raising money in a climate like that. But then also trying to sell something that people just didn't, not they didn't believe, they just didn't understand. And then if you look at everything else, it's the same after mobile. You know, I got out when it became cool.
Yeah.
And then that was like, well, what's next? People are talking about data, and I'm looking at analytics and predictive analytics and AI and that kind of stuff. And I don't have the brains to build those businesses. So the last, you know, the latter part of my last few years has been really humbling and being surrounded or invited to be surrounded by people way smarter than me who have the ability to create businesses and concepts around these new disciplines. And then I've been lucky enough to back some of these guys that have done great things.
Yeah. So you've been building and investing in over 30 companies and starting your own. You talk about a lot of lessons that you give in terms of vision and growth and mentorship guidance. I was wondering if you could share some of your perspective on choosing mentors, choosing people to influence and help your business. I mean, what is that process like? How do you protect yourself? What are your thoughts on building that out? And what are the right criteria or things to look for when looking at somebody who's really going to be influential in what you do?
Yeah, it's really, really good to kind of discuss. Personally, mentors, advisors have been a strategic advantage for me. They are actually in my business plans. So if I was to start another business today, which I'm probably not likely to, but every business that I have started in the plan that I've created or I've created with my team, there is a strategy for mentors and advisors. It's not just something that happens by accident. So that's how much weight I put on it. You make a very good point. You need to protect yourself. How do you find the right people? And what do you look for? We always look in startups for force multipliers, right? I mean, that's why you get mentors, to multiply the force that you don't have because you don't have the money, the time, the experience, etc. And so for me, it's always been, what am I going to need that I have to have in order to do well? And what can I not afford or what is scarce? The easiest ones are probably your more utilitarian ones like legal, finance. But what in finance, right? Is it acquisition? Is it money raising? Is it cash flow management? All those things that whatever you don't have, basically. So it's really questioning. You start with questioning yourself. What am I lacking? And then how can I fill those gaps? When you've kind of got a skill set, then it's actually looking for people. So again, it was strategic. So it has been strategic. And that's what I advise the companies that I work with today and the founders I work with today, is to sit down and actually follow a path, a strategy behind it. And identify who you want. So I remember when I started the Hyperfactory in 2000 with my brother, we made a list of people. You know, after we did the skill sets and stuff, we then said, okay, who are these people? Like literally, what are their names? Where are they? What country? Where do they work? If we could have a dream team of advisors, who would they be?
Yeah.
Shoot for the sky. And we did. And then we said, how do I get in touch with them? And we reached, and we had a plan, an engagement or an activation plan. And we ran and reached these people, people that normally you would see on TV or read about.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, most people who have done well are very, very generous with their time if you approach them in a thoughtful, deliberate manner. And so that's what we did. So I was always very lucky that I had a very strong advisory team around. But it's not an accident. It's just walking up to someone that said something nice at a seminar and saying, oh, can you help me? You get in trouble that way.
Yeah. I feel like every time I listen or read something from you, there's this... this, let's say, theme of preparation, of mindfulness into what you're doing. I mean, how much is that part of what your activation strategy?
Huge. Yeah, it is. Everything is very deliberate. So I think deliberate's a word I use a lot. Like, you need to be deliberate in what you do. You can't just have things happen. If things just happen, then things just happen. And if things just happen, the chances are they're not going to happen how you want them to happen. Mm-hmm. So if you want something to happen, make it happen or do what you can. If you don't plan, plan to fail.
Yeah.
It's true. So plans don't cost money. They just take time. And if you're smart enough to start a business, you're smart enough to make a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And everything should have a plan. Everything.
Yeah.
That's, you know. That's just what I feel. That's what I think. I wasn't always like this. This
is what maybe was a pivotal point that changed that made you decide that this is what needs to happen.
Reading a lot. Reading about other people that I admire and how they've started their businesses and lessons from them, and also my brother, to be honest, my middle brother, who I've learned a lot from. He's a much more naturally deliberate person than I am, and I saw that just made a lot more sense. And it's a reoccurring theme if you read or listen to the smarter guys than us. They constantly tell you that you need to think. You need to think about what you want and how you want to get there and make a plan for it. So I've been very big on evidence for the last couple of years. Everyone talks about data, 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 data. And it's not data, it's evidence. That's the point of data. Data points are evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just think about data without thinking of it as evidence, then it's a waste of time. And evidence is only useful if you have a plan to map against the evidence.
Right? And to make it actionable.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting because you have both sides of this journey. You can talk and, you know, you can be very informative about the having mentors prospect, but you are a mentor to a lot of companies. You're an advisor, you're an investor, you're a mentor. Could you talk about how you connect with people who focus on reasons to exist or why they're doing something versus someone who's just talking about what they built?
Yeah. I had this conversation the other day with someone. They asked me to look at their situation with hiring their corporate and how they could have a better talent acquisition strategy, basically. Mm-hmm. And after a bit of research, so I basically said to him, you're hiring based on what's and not how's, right? And that's kind of what we do as de facto. We judge things based on what when we should be judging on how.
Hmm.
It's not what you've done, it's how you've done it. Because if it's just what you've done, then if I put you in a different scenario, you're not going to be able to do it, right? But if it's how you've done things that I like or that's smart, well, then I can put you anywhere and you'll be able to operate like that. So what's versus how's are really important. For me as a mentor, I think back to the process that I use when I found mentors. And when I invest in a business, I give them as much of my money as I do my time. And so I choose those businesses carefully. But then I also play different roles to different businesses. And I will ask them, if I'm interested in giving them money, I need to know that they want my time too. So I will ask them if they can, how do you see me helping you? Like, where can I help you? And if it's a simple bench answer, like, oh, you can help me introduce me to people. You know what I mean? Like, it's that's not a mentor and that's not an advisor. That's a non-salaried commissioned salesperson. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's better sales guys than me right now. I mean, so it's figuring out stuff. Again, it's just that thoughtfulness and figuring out what they actually need. So for different companies that I advise or work with or help or founders that I help, I play different roles. So sometimes it's very specific in a talent way or a culture way and building cultural scale. And other times it might be market entry specifically for China, for example, or it could be fundraising or something else. But there's always a business case basically that says, this is where I can help you. And then I need to judge myself and say, well, if I'm going to commit and I'm going to do this at the end of X period, have I done my duty as a mentor or an advisor to you? And that's something I judge myself on, basically.
And you hold yourself accountable by the data.
Yeah.
What comes out of it, if you can see that there's been an impact, right?
Exactly, yeah.
I think you do talk also about this accountability in the whole chain, the whole cycle of investment, LPs, VCs, the founders, the founder team. I mean, we talk a lot about this, actually, in our own programs. We always talk about promises and value. We try to lay out a clear vision of what our promises are and what our value, and then we lay out what the promise we want to give that they're giving to us. We'll give you this promise, you give us that promise. And we talk about that in terms of value. We remind people of the intent of that promise and what it means. But you take it to a whole nother level. You talk about it in a way that I've never seen, which is a full circle analysis of the entire VC process down to the founders, down to their staff, and that promise. Because I mean, we don't want to be, I mean, you say it best. We don't want to be giving out people, you know, congratulations for not winning. We're, we have an epidemic of that.
Yeah.
But talk to me about that cycle. And what does that look like? And is that any different in China?
You're right. It is. We're in an epidemic of dancing around the truth, basically. We're scared to say you failed when you failed. Mm-hmm. Instead, we frame it as failing is great. Failing is not great, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not bad to fail. Do you know what I mean? There's a difference, yeah? Mm-hmm. We celebrate mediocrity and we celebrate the wrong things. That's not because we're inherently bad people. I think it's just because we haven't sat down and said, what's the outcomes that I'm actually marked on, right? Like, what's important? Where am I going? Mm-hmm. And when we do that, it's like a self-inflection or evaluation, right? When we do that, then when we get to those points of false praise or whatever, we would recognize, I don't need to be praised for that because that's not accomplished what I've set myself out to do, right? So starting with that honesty at the beginning, I think is really important. I think our generation has been brought up with the internet, the ability to break things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we do. We break stuff, but we break stuff because we think there's a better way. That's why all these guys are in this batch here at China Accelerator, yep, because they think they have a better way to do something. They're not inventing anything, right? We're not inventors, we're innovators, right? There's a big difference. Mm-hmm. So if we think that we have a better way and we feel so strongly about it that we're going to commit our own money, other people's money, and drag a whole bunch of people into a team to do it, well, surely, shouldn't we have the honesty or the integrity behind that as well to actually be clear, to measure our progress on what is our better way, as opposed to soft KPIs that don't actually, you know, even when you sit down and you say, what are your KPIs? Well, number of followers. Number of followers in a certain setting might make sense, but not when you're telling me you're going to do better, something better, right?
Yeah.
Or do something in a better way. I think, well, if you have that honesty in the beginning, that ability to look inside yourself, then you're able to be honest with others.
So this is coming from the partner side and the founder side. Both of them need this conversation,
yeah,
you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. And it's the same, you know, if you're investing in a company, you're clear about, you know, like you said, people making promises, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're clear about why you're putting that money in there and what you expect of that founding team and the founder.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just giving him money because you're sharing money. I mean, that's not what we do, right? We're giving him money because we expect him to do something. What is that something?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people leave it at, I expect him to do something. I expect them to grow, succeed, do well. That's meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
What does it actually mean, right? What does that success look like? What is the outcome? And evaluate on that at the end. So you mentioned a piece that I'd written about a company that I'd invested in and recently exited from, where an exit is great, fantastic, but it wasn't a great exit. And that wasn't the exit that the promise that we made collectively. So while everyone's congratulating each other, I was slightly annoyed enough to write a piece about it that said, why are we doing this?
Yeah.
We should actually be honest to ourselves and each other and say, hey, we've not done our job here. Mm-hmm. This is not the outcome we wanted. I'm not saying it's a bad outcome, but it's not the outcome we wanted. And that piece was titled, you know, Founder's Responsibility and Our Responsibility to Founders as Founder Investors.
Is that any different in China? Do you talk to Chinese investors or Chinese companies? Is there a difference in mind shift, or is that something that's...
There is a difference here, but there are differences. There are differences everywhere. I think it is also the first time that there has been active private sector money being invested, you know, in the last decade, really. Previous to that, there is very little personal money being invested into things from an angel or an ecosystem point of view. So they're at a different stage of the cycle. I think also here you've got different benchmarks. For example, if property is tripling in value every 5 years,
oh, wow, yeah,
well, then your understanding of returns are going to be very different, right?
I mean, very, very different
in
that
the
sense.
States, if you're happy in a portfolio, in a retirement portfolio, to get, you know, 9% a year and the top VC funds only return 30%, right? The top percentile are 36% if you're lucky, right? But here, if your property is guaranteed to do 300, you have different expectations.
I mean, what is the motivation then? If it's a very different motivation in China and a very different expectation, are they having that conversation, or are they just hedging their bets or investing for because they want to diversify or, mm-hmm. or get experience? I mean, is it an experience game or what is investor mentality in China, investing in China?
There is a macro forces at work, right? The government here is very active in driving the middle class growth and anything associated to that, and employment moving away from factories into digital related jobs and data related jobs or knowledge jobs. So when you have a force that powerful behind you, i.e. the Chinese government, then you have things in your favor. And so I think that makes the investment climate locally more positive in that mm-hmm. respect. And also, we just have some really great homegrown success stories here. I mean, everyone around the world knows who Jack Ma is, right?
Yeah.
And 10 years ago, they didn't. And so when you have guys like that, you know, the founder of C-Trip and the rest of those guys that have done really well globally, you know, mm-hmm. or on a global scale, that's enough to inspire mm-hmm. everyone. I mean, you look at your batches now, you're at batch 10.
Yeah.
Batches, your applications are larger than they ever were. Mm-hmm. You're seeing it firsthand. You know, people have this inherent inspiration now.
Yeah, the community is, I would say, entranced by this idea of startups now. And some points, very, very good because it gives more visibility, more resources. But at the same time, like you said, you want people who are in the game for the big win.
Be careful with big win, though, because I think that's something that I've seen probably over the last 12, 18 months as that term, the unicorn term mm-hmm. was coined, and everyone was chasing that title mm-hmm. and success was equal to how much money or valuation, right?
Yeah.
Which is just inherently so flawed, it's not funny. But it wasn't cool to say that, right? Mm-hmm. The contrarian that I am, I have been saying that for a while. And so, for example, I spent a lot of time in New Zealand, and in New Zealand, it's a very small country. It's at the bottom of the world. They have a lot of strengths, but they have, you know, obvious inherent disadvantages. And statistical or evidence, empirical evidence says, you know, there haven't been a million successful startups that have come out of New Zealand over the last decade. There just hasn't. There is no yeah. evidence that that's happened, right? And so to have a whole population as enamored with startups as they are here in China too, mm-hmm. but everyone walking around saying that they're going to be this next billion-dollar business or whatever is inherently flawed, mm-hmm. statistically flawed, empirically flawed. It just, the chances of that happening, doesn't matter who you are, what you're mm-hmm. going to do, the chance of that happening are almost nil, right?
Wow.
So that doesn't mean don't start things, but I've been telling the people that I work with in New Zealand and the universities there and saying the focus needs to move away from unicorns to workhorses.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with creating $100 million business that returns $20 million a year in dividends to shareholders or reinvest into the business and will continue to grow and sustains employment for 1,000
yeah.
people. There's nothing wrong with having 10 of those in a country like New Zealand.
No, I right. totally agree. I mean, this is something that is echoed by what we do in our VC. Mm. I mean, we William Balbine talks about cockroaches.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
invest in people who will never die.
Yep.
They no matter what, they will succeed. They'll find a way no yep. matter what. It's how, it's not what or why.
Yep. So important.
Yeah. So I know we're tight on time. I want to ask you one last question that I was burning to ask, and I'm sorry we don't have enough time to kind of flesh it out, but I really want to ask you about the secret co-founder idea, because you started your companies, a lot of them with your brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always trying to get this understanding of the importance of the secret co-founder, basically your family, your loved ones in there and how they support you. How big of a effect were your secret co-founders in your,
huge,
in your business and your investing and everything?
Huge force multiplier. So important. I had a meeting with one of the founders of one of the batches of your batch today, and he's by himself. You know, he's got a team of five or whatever, and he's a single founder. And it's one of the loneliest journeys, right? If you read anything that any founder's ever written, they will tell you it's a lonely, lonely journey.
Mm-hmm.
For me, having my brothers involved and behind me and me behind them just gave us an immense amount of strength. When you're sitting across a table, whether it's venture capital or with a client or whatever, when there's two of you with the same blood, nothing can beat you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that support is so, so important.
Mm.
I think a lot of founders think they have to go it alone.
True.
And they don't trust people. And I think it's silly. Because we know, again, empirical evidence says that you are two brains are stronger than one. So you need to find those people that are able to provide you that support. They could be wife, husband, brothers, sisters, cousins, whatever, or just, you know, best friends from high school. Yeah. I don't know. You know, if you look at every successful team or every successful business, it's always been a team. There's always two or three co-founders in every single one that, you know, historically that we remember from IBM and HP. Look, HP is two names, right? Yeah. Hewlett and Packard. All the way through to Microsoft, Uber, Snapchat, all of them. Mm-hmm. There is always more than one person there. And that's what gives you that strength. But it's also humbling because then that's recognizing that someone at the top with you is smarter than you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the key to doing anything well, really, is recognizing that there is always a better way and there's always someone smarter than you. I wake up every morning and the first thing I tell myself is I am wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely inspiring advice. Excellent. So I think, you know, I want to end this with, how can people get a hold of you? I know that you're always welcoming people to contact you and help them if you have a way to help them, right?
Yeah.
So how do people get a hold of you? How do you prefer people to reach out to you right now?
Very easy. My email is jeffrey@jeffreyhandley.com. And I respond to every email. Very open to helping people, but obviously I need to know that I can be of service in order to help. Definitely. And I spend time here and we'll China Accelerator. So anyone that's here in the batches here or anyone that's coming here, they can always grab me here too.
Excellent. Cool. All right, Jeffrey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate it. This is a wonderful, wonderful talk about all these great things.
Congratulations on your 1 year.
Yeah, 1 year. So once again, thank you, Jeffrey. Thank you to David. Thank you to Vivian, our producer. Thank you to all the listeners, because you guys are definitely why we do this. And we care so much about sharing this incredible information. So thank you guys, and catch you guys next episode. Hey everyone, I want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsors. China Accelerator is the number one internet accelerator in Asia. It's part of the SOSV Accelerator family, which is 9 accelerators all over the world in 4 verticals: hardware, food, biotech, and internet. It is a 3-month intensive program that's mentorship driven, focused on demo day, getting your product and your market and your fit just right. China Accelerator does cross-border innovation, bringing ideas from all over the world into China and Chinese ideas out into the world. You can find out more and apply online at ChinaAccelerator.com. Entrepreneurs wanted. People Squared is the original co-working space in China. It's your home for startups, no matter what you're working on. Small team or large, it has all the resources, the environment, the culture, everything that you need to take your idea and make it successful. Founded by Bob Jung, an entrepreneur himself who really understands what startups need, it's a great place to bring your team and find success. You can find out more at people-squared.com. Our syndication partner is techno.cn, the number one resource for information about startups in the investment environment in China. They focus on getting the word globally about what's happening and growing in China in terms of trends and startup evolutions. You can find out more at technode.cn.